Let's pick up where we left off. We're talking about peptic ulcer disease. I think I mentioned, didn't I, the genetic link, that it occurs 2 to 3 times more frequently when there's a family history? Okay. Environmentally speaking, there seem to be some connections to alcohol, especially beer, smoking, caffeine, are all possible links to gastritis, but the research is not conclusive on that. We do know that alcohol and caffeine are both potent stimulators of hydrochloric acid secretion. Excessive vagal stimulation is also something that can lead to more secretion of gastric juices. Hydrochloric acid production is influenced by several different factors, including neural and hormonal stimulation. So these are environmental things that can lead to increased production of gastric secretion. Another is infection of the H. pylori, which is how that is abbreviated, H. pylori bacterium. So peptic ulcer disease has now an expanded definition, meaning ulcerations of the mucosa somewhere. And it tends to have a pattern of coming and going, exacerbations and remissions. The drugs, particularly the NSAID category, play a part in the development of gastric and some duodenal ulcers. Aspirin also damages the surface of the mucosa directly. So those can be contributing kinds of things from the drug category. Having a personal history of peptic ulcer disease, or PUD, predisposes that person to the development of cancer of the stomach. There's a high correlation there. Incidence of peptic ulcer disease also increases with age. If it's a duodenal ulcer, this placement of the ulcer disease occurs more frequently in young adults, much more frequent for them in the duodenal area than in the gastric or stomach area. A gastric ulcer, or meaning in the stomach itself, is more common for older adults. Both types of ulcers affect men 3 to 4 times as frequently as they affect women. Some of the clinical manifestations: not a real fun picture. Some of them, however, don't have any symptoms. I've seen this a little more commonly with the ones that are drug-induced. But pain is a part of this disease, and it can be the thing that gets them to an office somewhere. A feeling of fullness or epigastric distension, nausea, distension, all common GI kinds of symptoms. Doesn't mean that they definitely have all of them. Some of them may have none of them. I've seen elderly people not have any complaint of pain and suddenly start to have some GI bleeding because of the ulceration. Medical management of this problem is to use drugs that lower or eliminate acid secretions from the parietal cells. And that's why you're seeing so much of the proton pump inhibitors, the Prevacid type drugs. and they will tend to go to those rather than the H2 antagonists. But you will still occasionally see those used. If it's an infectious process and there is a test that they can do for that, to test for the H. pylori, then there will be treatment also using antibiotics. If this is a gastric ulcer problem or PUD problem that seems to be related to drug influence, NSAIDs or aspirin, Cytotec might be used, another drug, CYTOTEC. It's an anti-ulcer drug that protects the gastric mucosa pretty efficiently from NSAID injury. NSAIDs. NSAIDS, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. The use of Pepto-Bismol, which is a solution that's been around for a long, long time, an over-the-counter pink solution, seems to have a direct antibacterial effect on an organism's attachment to the mucosal. So with food poisoning or for short-term relief from H. pylori, it might be effective there, but it is not the drug of choice for treating H. pylori. That would be rather regular bacterial, tetracycline or amoxicillin or flagyl.
Is H. pylori just a general name for any stomach infection, or is that a type of bacteria?
It's a type of bacteria. It's a type of bacteria.
How do you get it? Is it just a small? Like, is it something that's in your stomach normally and it overflows, or is it something you have to
I'm not sure if it's. If it comes in on food, I'm not sure if it's, I know what, I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure. But it's something that initially is not killed by the gastric acids. Must come in with food.
It's not like almost like a normal flora of the stomach
that No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah, I'll find out. I'll find out. But there is a test that they can do for it, and if that's the problem, really kind of pinpoint it with the antibiotics and deal with it that way. There is a surgical procedure for peptic ulcers. I'm not going to do it now. We'll cover that when we're looking at gastric cancer. Well, I lied. I guess I decided to put it in here. Just some definition of terms. A vagotomy is a removal of the vagal innervation to the fundus part of the stomach. It interrupts the vagal pathway from producing acid in the parietal cells of the stomach. So this is an innervation. It removes that innervation message. An antrectomy is an entire removal of the antrum, front part of the stomach, the gastrin-producing portion of the lower part. And then there are different types of antrectomies. There is something called a Billroth 1, which is part of the duodenum also, a gastroduodenostomy. How's that? A removal of the distal half of the stomach where the pylorus valve is. And then, and there's a good picture, there's some good pictures of this in your book, okay? With an anastomosis of that part of the stomach then to the duodenum, with usually a vagotomy done at the same time. Talking about Billroth 1 here. What ends up happening is that the size of the stomach is decreased. So there can be problems afterwards with feelings of fullness and problems with absorption because there's not as much absorption surface. So problems with absorption and emptying and feelings of fullness. It just changes the dynamics of the stomach. Not as severe as bariatric surgery where they do the stomach stapling and for a different reason. This person is more subject then to diarrhea, having diarrhea afterwards, and what's called the dumping syndrome, and we'll look at that separately. The Bill Roth 2 is a slightly different procedure. The duodenum is just kind of closed off, and the fundus of the stomach is anastomosed or reconnected down to a different part of the small intestine of the jejunum. I think I have some pictures here of these two. The Bill Roth 1 up there and the Bill Roth 2. Both of these are done with the intent of decreasing acid production. So it's a matter of eliminating the area where those parietal cells are, eliminating the numbers of them. This is not a first-line medical approach to this problem. The first-line approach is going to be drug therapy. And it's only when that has proved to be unsuccessful with a different kinds of things and with the person pursuing this problem that a different route is going to be investigated.
Is that showing blood vessel on the stomach or the nerve?
Nerve. Vagotomy. They're talking about a vagotomy also. Okay, now we go to the next portion of the notes. You know, I need to get from let me get my own copy of those. I don't have that. Starting with okay, looking at chronic gastritis, this is something that's correlated with advancing age. The incidence increases. Listed under a type A autoimmune problem, these are persons whose bodies have decided to attack some of its own gastric parietal cells. So their body produces some antibodies to do this. If this occurs, it can eventually cause or lead to something called pernicious anemia from lack of something labeled the intrinsic factor. The intrinsic factor is secreted by the parietal cells of the stomach. An intrinsic factor is needed for the intestinal absorption of the vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is essential for the formation of red blood cells. Its deficiency results in pernicious anemia. This condition of chronic gastritis can predispose a person to gastric cancer or cancer of the stomach. Vitamin B12 injections are something that then need to be given to somebody if they do develop the disease called pernicious anemia, because their body no longer has the ability to absorb this vitamin in order to make red blood cells, so they have to be given it outside. You may occasionally see vitamin B12 injections in other places too. It can be used for prophylaxis and for treatment of some diseases where there is defective red blood cell formation. So it's not purely restricted to lack of intrinsic factor, but it's definitely connected with that one. Because they don't eat the meat, yeah. If they're careful and they're able to get it in other ways, if a person wants to be a strict vegetarian, they really have to make a commitment to that, and making a commitment to that, they can have an excellent diet. Post-op problems, getting back to the surgical approach, the Bill Roth 1 and the Bill Roth 2, that decreases the size of the stomach and usually includes a vagotomy to eliminate the number of parietal cells that are secreting the gastric acid. So getting back to that surgery, that's what I'm referring to. Remember I said I would say something about the symptom called dumping syndrome. And there's the definition of what it is. It's just a rush of entry from the stomach contents into the small intestine. And it's a fairly high percentage of people who experience this. And that's a list of symptoms that come with it that aren't fun, that end up making the person feel like something is really, really not okay. It feels like, until they recognize it, it feels like a much more serious set of events, like this could really be something terrible that's going on. So anybody who has this kind of surgery, and this would include people who are having the bariatric surgery for stomach stapling and so forth, need to know the list of symptoms of what's involved here so that they don't get overly frightened, and need to know what to do to try to prevent that. What's happening is the food, and that's in the stomach, or the chyme, we'll call it, has a different osmolarity. It's hyperosmolar. More dense, if you will, in terms of osmolarity than the secretions in the jejunum, in that part of the small intestine. And this causes then the fluid to be drawn from the bloodstream through the capillary walls and into the jejunum to try to equalize and balance things out. And so what happens is fluid's being pulled from the blood plasma, and this ends up decreasing the blood volume. And this causes then a drop in blood pressure or hypotension. So this is a fluid shifting kind of thing that's dealing with hyperosmolarity of the food into this small intestine. A second factor in the dumping syndrome is related to the ingestion of sugar. And I mean sugar that is simple sugars, okay? Not complex carbs, but simple sugars. with the ingestion of sugar products, simple sugars, everything is speeded up. And then the glucose rapidly enters the bloodstream from the large amount of food that's suddenly dumped into the intestine. And with that, then there is an increased secretion of insulin from the body because it's gotten the message that now that there's glucose in the bloodstream that needs to be moved into the cells for energy. And when that insulin does that and the glucose is moved into the cells, then there's a subsequent fall in blood sugar level to subnormal levels, which is called hypoglycemia. And these changes in blood sugar are very rapid, and the hypoglycemia is very dramatic. So that's a second factor in the dumping syndrome. A third factor in the dumping syndrome is called a gastric colic reflex trigger. Gastric colic, like a baby has colic, C-O-L-I-C. This rapid emptying and moving of the chyme food product into the small intestine from the smaller stomach triggers something called a gastrocolic reflex. And this causes diarrhea. It causes a feeling of fullness and discomfort. It can occur during a meal or from 5 to 30 minutes after a meal. May last for 20 to 60 minutes. The speed with which it happens is very rapid. This type of reflex, this dumping kind of syndrome that can have these components to it, can also sometimes follow other kinds of gastric surgery, such as some people who have gallbladder surgery, even laparoscopic kind, can end up with this syndrome for a while, particularly the gastrocolic portion of it, where they have an immediate reflex within their bodies which propels the food forward, and they have this rapid peristalsis and literally run to the bathroom. They may be sitting at the table in a restaurant having a meal or something, and literally it is that fast. It doesn't go on for very long, but it certainly feels rather bizarre to this person who's had this. So a person who is going to have this kind of surgery needs to know about the dumping syndrome so that they don't think they're having a stroke or a heart attack or some strange thing, that these are happening because of physiological shifts and things that their body is compensating for, and it all happens very quickly, and this is how it can feel. And then, of course, not only are they armed with that information, then they are given information of these are some things you can do to prevent this from happening because this is not fun.
How long does that last?
Not very long. The whole thing probably might be a memory after an hour. Okay? The whole thing. But the people plan for this who've had this surgery. Like if they're going to a wedding where there's this big buffet or, you know, anything where there's a lot going on or a party kind of thing, they have to be very measured in how they do things. And they have to look for their satisfaction through other means, not just food. You know, it has to be sociability. They have to monitor their alcohol. And they have to eat very carefully and slowly. And amount is the big thing. Amount is the really big thing, and selection of things. So here are some things that they can be given as for tools to arm themselves with this. Here's the term moderate. You should underline the term moderate. Moderate fat, high protein. Limited on the sugars, limited on the carbs. So the South Beach diet would work here, huh? Small, more frequent meals. And avoidance of simple sugars totally. Now this is a challenge. This is this ends up having all kinds of emotional kinds of components and feeling left out. If you're a person whose life is really really enjoyed food and you've enjoyed it for all the right reasons and perhaps some not so right reasons, we all have connections with foods. But avoiding simple sugars completely, these are dietary restrictions that cast a pall on some people's way of dealing with things. And other people simply accept them. A lot of people who have transplant surgery, kidney transplant surgery and other kinds of transplant, have to make dietary modifications in this way regarding the simple sugars because of the insulin flux and the different things that happen. So it is an adjustment. The reason for no fluids with the meals is because it adds to the volume. This would be a very hard surgery for me to have because I'm a volume person. Two cups of cabbage is okay. Just give me a lot of it. Whatever it is, I want a lot of it. Now, if it happens to be brownies, that gets into a difficulty, right? And I love, don't ever tell me to take my volume or my water or my iced tea or whatever away from. I want two glasses of it. And it's the whole volume issue. So this would be a real learning thing for me. This would be very difficult.
Don't they say that now with, like if you watch the programs now, like it's always, you lose weight with the gastroparticipant, you lose weight, but nobody ever said the psychological impact.
Oh. Yeah.
And they did this one person, and the mental effect, and I would have never thought of that, the mental effect on the food, and she was devastated. She goes, I cried for months. I couldn't eat because it made me ill. And she says, the mental effect that it had on me, she goes, I can't get over it. She couldn't surpass that point.
There's more to food than just the taking in of food. There's all these associations with it, yes. I heard had a friend who had a diet who was had a daughter who was pretty overweight and really decided to make some pretty serious life changes and approached it rationally and was changing how she dealt with food and ate and all this kind of thing. But every once in a while, her mother said she would go to the refrigerator and just kind of open the door and look. And her mother asked her what she was doing. She said, "Well, I'm just visiting some old friends." Cute. But that kind of sums up what you're saying. There is this whole mental, emotional kind of thing that is connected with the foods that we take in, because the foods that we take in become a part of who we are. So it's a very intimate kind of thing when you think of it that way. So this is a rather major modification for someone who's food-focused. Now, I'm a food-focused person, but a lot of people are not. You know, there are people who just, you know, they have to do it because they have to eat. But, and there are people who forget to eat. I've never understood those people. I've often wondered, and I thought, and been a little envious of that. So we're wired a little differently, or we're taught a little differently, whatever. But, yeah.
Not just the addictions. But my aunt is very obese.
Okay. Oh, she did.
And she's lost my body weight, pretty much. And at first, it's not just, like, you get used to losing. She lost, like, 80 pounds in the first couple months. Mm-hmm. And then it dropped literally, like, the amount of weight she was losing. It didn't, she wasn't losing, it was very slow. And that really sent her really depressed.
Oh,
she
did it? Well, she would get so keyed up from that fast weight loss, I guess. Lots and lots. Okay.
Ever since she was a baby, but she like got severely depressed and like was missing the food because she wasn't losing as much weight as she was expecting.
Because the food was an emotional kind of thing for her.
120 pounds that she's lost, which is like a person.
Yeah.
And she's still depressed because she's not losing more. She's still fat, and she's missing that food. I mean, like my parents saw her walking into Wendy's a couple months ago, and you know, we're like, you wonder if like that. Expects to lose so much weight, and I guess she just expected it to be like this miracle.
But if you see
without
like what they're allowed to eat,
it's like, nothing. And for the first couple weeks, it was like all liquid.
Yeah.
She couldn't have any solid food. So
right.
Because you can't, the stomach is so, went from like being this big to being like this big, and it cannot handle it.
Yeah. Is she still that heavy anymore?
She's still heavy. She really is.
She's got a lot of problems. Like, I mean, when she was a kid, she had a, like a very serious brain disease, and I can't remember what she had, but it's, it kind of retarded her in the sense that she's
okay.
And
okay.
She's had many problems, and being obese, like, it really...
It just adds to her physical problems.
And she's just got mental problems, and she, I think that, like, you know, she's got an emotional level of, like, a 15-year-old.
Okay.
But it's, like, it, food, to them, is, like, their life.
It is, really it is the... So when you hear the... But you can't do that.
Liquid.
Yeah. I would think that kind of elective approach to that type of surgery would have to involve a lot more than just physical preparation, the whole emotional aspect of it, which would be tough with somebody who's
yeah.
I know it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes.
She was probably like 500 pounds my height.
Mm. Oh my God.
Like 5'3", I'm 5'1", and I could not imagine being 5 times my size. And like,
oh, just the moving, the weight, the like just terrible. Yeah.
And she's 4 years old.
Yeah.
And she couldn't breathe. It wasn't for cosmetic reasons.
So this had to look like This was life saving surgery, really, for her. Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah.
And
of
it's course. Kind of hard for her to understand, but it was a major, major, major thing. She
and there can be major complications with that surgery. You know, Jersey Shore is no longer doing it right now. They are not doing their surgery right now. It's being reevaluated. It's come on the scene, like, in the last couple of years as like another diet or, you know, this kind of thing. And it's not. It's really much more serious than that. Mm-hmm.
I know you had, like, where I was, you had to have, the guy that did it in our hospital, you had to have a year of psych, like, all psych stuff before he even did it.
Well, now that sounds smart.
Even, like, the guy that I knew was very heavy, and he had it, but even though he knew him for years because he worked in the OR, he still had to wait a year for the psych to make sure and go through, like, certain counselings and, you know, to look at it in order for him to even have it.
Yes.
Because it's such a, he wound up going through, he lost so much. He looks like an AIDS patient. Like it just,
really?
Yeah, like he's ashen, like he's all on ones, and like it's, to go from like such a big person, like, and then you're so skinny, like you're hunched, and like it's just such a drastic, it's just weird. Mm-hmm. Such a drastic change. That's why I was amazing that she didn't lose.
Well, part of that difference might be that he's male, and males have a larger proportion of muscle to fat, even if male is very, very heavy, and muscle will has a higher rate of burning calories. It will metabolize quicker, and males will always lose faster than females because of that difference. Right, and she probably couldn't, and she would probably be very sedentary because it becomes painful to move that amount of weight around. Very difficult. Just think of any normal, any standard daily behavior in and out of a car, you know, on and off of a toilet, cleaning yourself after having a bowel movement. These things become big issues for people who are carrying that amount of weight. Out of a bathtub, I mean, all kinds of things.
Thinking about the emotional or psychological aspect, the people are using food as an addiction.
Yes.
Like smoke is an addiction or drink is an addiction. But with obesity, it's not just giving it up. Like, you have to get control of it because you can't just not eat.
Because you can't just not eat. It's not like, you know, with alcohol or cigarettes, you can put it over and you can live without it. But you've got to have certain nutrients or you won't survive.
I look at somebody like her and I
can't really relate to that. I understand she works very hard physically. Yeah. I read a part of the book that she and that trainer she had, the physical guy, I can't remember the name of it, when she first started with the exercises. This was several years back. You know, when she got ready to run the marathon and all of that. And he wrote in the beginning part, I guess they did it every other chapter, they each one wrote something like that. And in the beginning of his, what he said was, Oprah, he had gotten to know her pretty well, and she is an amazing person in terms of motivation. And if she decides to do something, she will do it, no matter what it takes. And getting out of bed at 5 a.m. and doing those, and she did it, he said. But she has not been blessed with a metabolism that helps her in any way. There is nothing in her physiological makeup that she's never going to shed weight easily. It's just not going to happen. I think starting next week she's having some kind of show, or maybe it's a series about how she did this. Because evidently they've gotten an awful lot of emails and inquiries on this. Because if you look at any of her older shows, you can see, I mean, she almost looks like a different person. She looks so much healthier now. It's just amazing. I think so. Yeah. What? Yeah. That's not news, right? That's not news from anybody. It's the same thing. Yeah. I think possibly, at least that's what this male author was saying, that she had to work a little bit harder at the exercise because just reducing the food intake didn't do it. She had to work at it. Okay, a few other things that we can add to this list that this person is going to have to deal with. If they're in a place where they can lie down after they eat on their left side, if you just think of the anatomy of the stomach, it can delay the emptying from the stomach into the intestine. Just kind of hold it in there for a little bit longer. Now, that's obviously not possible at a lot of places, but if they're at home and they might prop themselves in that way, maybe that can do it. There are some antispasmodic drugs and some anticholinergic drugs. I'm not even going to mention those that can be used. They would rather not use those. And if they avoid very extreme temperatures of food, very hot or very cold, which seems to trigger things a little bit more. So there's a lot they have to think about. This then kind of governs that part of their life. You know, they cannot be spontaneous in those ways. And they really have to think about when and how and how much they are eating. Okay, let's move into gastric cancer. Now, is this where you go to the next? Okay. Okay, first statement doesn't tell us that we've learned a whole lot. Don't know what's causing this particular kind of cancer, why those cells go awry. But there seem to be all kinds of things correlated or connected with it, and that's That's what that next part of the list has on it. In addition to those things, the incidence of this particular kind of cancer is higher in men over the age of 40. And here's an interesting thing. Japan has a 4 times greater stomach cancer rate than this country. And Japan is a very small country. Packed, but small country. One of the problems with gastric cancer is that it's often not diagnosed until it has metastasized. This sounds familiar, doesn't it? So what I was talking about, oral cancers. So 3/4 of people who are diagnosed with stomach cancer already have metastasis. The stomach is able to accommodate to the growth of the tumor. Think of a Thanksgiving meal or any kind of overeating, the stomach has the ability to stretch and grow. So you don't have the same sense of pressure or filling up a space. Like we've talked about, when a kidney stone is going through the ureter and gets stuck, there's not much space in the diameter of that ureter, and then the symptoms of pain are right there. Not so with stomach cancer. It just kind of expands with it. The area of metastases are esophagus, spleen, pancreas, liver, or bone. So this is a very geographical kind of thing. All these things are direct vascular routes and close lymphatic routes also. Now, heredity is not anything that any of us can do anything about. Those are the cards that were dealt. So the two things on this list that are lifestyle changes, of course, are the smoking, and then the processed or cured foods that contain nitrates lacking in fruits and vegetables. Now, I had two low-fat hot dogs last night for supper, along with some vegetables and some other things. But that was what I wanted. I will get on a little hot dog binge every once in a while. I might go for a year without it. Okay, and all of a sudden I want the nitrates. You know, I want the flavoring that's in there. But I've certainly gotten away from regular hot dogs and everything. So I don't think once a year is too bad. Or actually had them last week too, so I'm on a little roll here. But I think when this package is done, it's got to be done. Maybe I'll freeze the rest of them or something. But if somebody eats processed or cured foods on a regular basis, you know, if every day is the sandwich from the Wawa, nothing against Wawa, or every day, you know, always shopping at the parts of the store where the deli stuff is and everything, and not going for the whole foods or the fresh foods, not going for the veggies and the fruits, because the other thing is more condensed. It's easy, it's quick, somebody else can do it for you. I mean, I understand all of that. But if that's something that is a day-in, day-out, year-in, year-out pattern of eating, there seems to be a connection there with those kinds of ongoing dietary choices. So what are some of the symptoms here? Loss of appetite, that anorexia. Eructation is a fancy word for belching, heartburn, fatigue, weakness. Filling up early because there's other stuff there taking up space. And then the signs or the symptoms of other kinds of malignancies, weight loss, anemia, blood in the stool would be a GI problem related to this. But the weight loss with this, with gastric cancer, is kind of amazingly fast. It's rapid and it's severe. This is one of the reasons that if people go for any kind of an annual or regular physical exam, even if it's irregular, one of the things that will always be included in that is weight, and to see if there's been any radical change, because that is a symptom that goes with many different malignancies. And sometimes at the beginning of it, it's so subtle that people don't aware. What I'm saying here is this is not subtle. this is very rapid and very quick, and not only will they know it, but people around them will know it, okay? A couple of months and, you know, 30 and 40 pounds, stuff like that. The treatment for this kind of cancer is radiation. However, radiation by itself is not very effective. Chemotherapy, and what they will usually do is combine the two, radiation and chemotherapy. They're a little more effective if done together. Even that, it is frequently, because it's usually metastasized by the time it's diagnosed, is a palliative kind of approach. If surgery is needed to take out the tumor, or what can be taken out, it will usually be a Bill Roth II type of surgery. And this becomes a mixed bag as to what to do first, because the radiation therapy will shrink tumors. And sometimes that's what you really need to do because of the space that the tumor is taking up and the pressure that it's putting on other things and all of that. And whenever you radiate a tumor, of course, you're going through other tissues and you're damaging and killing other cells. It is more focal, certainly, but it causes other symptoms, one of those being anorexia and nausea and vomiting and all of that. You also have to go through the skin for this kind of radiation, so it damages the skin. It makes the skin then not as good at healing if surgery is done later. So what is done first? This is a team approach where a surgeon, an oncologist, and the whole diagnostic picture have to be put up on a board and say, well, what is our best approach? And looking at this individual's collection of data, looking at the data from around the country and what are our chances here, and putting that out all on the board for this patient and their family to say, here's the picture, and here's what we would recommend, or here are your options. And of course, in today's world, many people are very, very informed, and they can get information from all kinds of places on the internet and explore other options. And they don't have to just go to one physician and take that. Other people will go to their physician because this is the person they've gone to for many, many years, and that's what they're comfortable with. Some people don't want this decision. It's too scary for some people. They want to be able to put their trust in somebody else, and so they do it that way. Other people will do all kinds of other things. So the approaches will vary. A lot of this depends on personality, support, familiarity and comfort level with the healthcare environment, how they're feeling at this point in time, what it is in their own family history. If their mother had gastric cancer and they were with them when she went through all this, a lot of potent memories there. If other people in their family have these kinds of cancers. So there's a lot in that kind of picture that will influence a person's decision and help determine the road they're going to take. Okay, we're still moving down the track here and to ulcerative colitis. Appropriate picture, don't you think? This is a tough chronic problem to live with. This is a real toughie. And you see that is the first word here, is chronic. Inflammatory disease. Don't know really what gets it to start up. Lots of investigation going on in that. Major symptom, and look at the number. Look at the number there, 20 to 30. Diarrheal stools a day. What does this do to the rectal sphincter? What does this do to the skin in that area? What does this do? I mean, this is very, very uncomfortable and annoying. And How do you live your life from the toilet? Sure. Sure.
Thank you. A very dear friend of mine has it, and there are times when he's out on disability because it is recurring, and he just can't move out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are some physicians who are approaching this a little bit differently. Years ago, this used to be thought of as a psychogenic kind of origins, that this was people who were highly agitated or anxious and that kind of thing. It's now known that this is not the case. There are some mucosal lining differences in this person's tract. Some other symptoms that can come along with this can be anemia, because you can have some blood loss from all this activity along the mucosal lining of the GI tract, low-grade fever, certainly weakness, anorexia. These people can end up getting very thin, because one of the things that they learn is if they don't take food in, there's less to go through their tract and there's less time spent in the bathroom. And it becomes something that they can do and will often choose to do. Then that leads to muscle weakness and debilitation, dehydration, nausea. It's thought by some that this might be another type of autoimmune kind of problem, but that is not sure. It is a disease that is, again, characterized by remissions and exacerbations. So it has this kind of up and down pattern to it. It's the age for it is generally, the highest frequency is for, this is a young adult age, 15 to 25. So this is a young person's disease. And it tends to cluster in families. This is common among families. The research has now finally documented that there are no psychosomatic factors. This is not the cause. There are no personality traits that lead a person to be more prone to have this. Having this particular problem of ulcerative colitis, which used to be called Crohn's disease, C-H-R-O-N-E-S, predisposes this person to the development of cancer of the colon and cancer of the rectum. There are much higher rates of patients with these two kinds of cancers who have ulcerative colitis than the general population. So we know that that's a predisposing kind of thing. So this is an inflammatory bowel disease. The terms ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease have similarities, certainly, with data and with looking at very more specific things than we're going to look at here. They can separate them out and say, this is ulcerative colitis, this is Crohn's disease. Okay. They do have a lot of similarities, however. Let's look at a treatment mode here. Class is over. Well, forget the treatment. We'll just leave this person on the toilet and we'll just come back later.